So today, I read you from the Srimad Bhagavatam, second canto, chapter 2, canto 2, chapter 8, text 13 and 14, and verse 14 is on the board. Okay, before we do the word for word, I'm going to go to the previous verse, which we didn't recite. Translation is, O purest of the Brahmanas, please also explain the cause of the different durations of time, both short and long, as well as the beginning of time, following the course of action. And now we have this verse, translation. Then again, kindly describe how the proportionate accumulation of the reactions resulting from the different modes of material nature act upon the desiring living being, promoting or degrading him among the different species of life, beginning from the demigods down to the most insignificant creatures. That was one sentence. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The actions and reactions of all works in the material modes of nature, either in the minute form or in the gigantic form, are accumulated. And thus the result of such accumulated actions and reactions of karma or work become manifested in the same proportion. How such actions and reactions take place, what the different procedures are, and in what proportion they act are all subject matters of Maharaj Parikshit's inquiries from the great Brahmana Shukadeva Goswami. So that paragraph there combined both verses. Life in the higher planets, known as the abode of the demigods of heaven, is obtained not by the strength of spacecraft, as is now being contemplated by the inexperienced scientists, but by works done in the mode of goodness. Even on the very planet where we are now living, there are restrictions upon the entrance of foreigners into a country where the citizens are more prosperous. For example, the American government has many restrictions for the entrance of foreigners from less prosperous countries. The reason is that the Americans do not wish to share their prosperity with any foreigner who has not qualified himself as a citizen of America. Similarly, the same mentality is prevailing in every other planet where there are more intelligent living beings residing. The higher planetary living conditions are all in the mode of goodness. And anyone desiring to enter the higher planets like the Moon, Sun, and Venus must qualify thoroughly by activity in complete goodness. Maharaj Parikshit's inquiries are on the basis of proportionate actions of goodness, which qualify one in this planet to be promoted to the highest regions of the universe. Even on this planet of our present residence, one cannot achieve a good position within the social order without being qualified with proportionate good work. One cannot forcibly sit on the chair of a high court judge without being qualified for the post. Similarly, one cannot enter into the higher planetary systems without being qualified by good works in this life. Persons addicted to the habits of passion and ignorance have no chance of entering the higher planetary systems simply by an electronic mechanism. According to the statement of the Bhagavad Gita, 9.25, persons trying to qualify themselves for promotion to the higher heavenly planets can go there. Similarly, persons trying for the Pitri Lokas can go there. Similarly, persons trying to improve the conditions on this earth can also do that. And persons who are engaged in going back home, back to Godhead, can achieve that result. The various actions and reactions of work in the mode of goodness are generally known as pious work with devotional service, culture of knowledge with devotional service, mystic powers with devotional service, and at last, devotional service unmixed with any other varieties of goodness. This unmixed devotional service is transcendental and is called para-bhakti. It alone can promote a person to the transcendental kingdom of God. Such a transcendental kingdom is not a myth, but is as factual as the moon. One must have transcendental qualities to understand the kingdom of God and God himself. Om Agyana Timanandasya Janan Jana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So this is extraordinary verses with extraordinary information there within them. And it also shows the characteristics of Parikshit, that he's able to even ask these questions. Obviously, the questions themselves are revealing almost their answers. He's asking a question in the same way. It's like it's just so full of wisdom in the questions that he's asking. So he didn't just suddenly turn up on the bank of a river and what's going on. He already was fully equipped with this information. So his questions are, I don't know if you look at the time frame what he's doing this, he's actually going to die. So he's obviously, every second of his time is of intrinsic value. So his questions are important because they're about realities, about Krishna, about the universe, as the nature of his questions. So he's kind of, you know, asking the question, and he's entering deep into, tell us about this. I mean, look at this first point here, that Kalasya Anugati Yatu, that Prabhupada says Kala means eternal time. This is, I mean, people don't even know what time is. When did time begin? How was time created? Where was it? So here Prabhupada says, well, the first of all, time is eternal. And then it talks about beginning of time. And it talks about small and large time. The word is Lakshya, which means how we experience time. Although time is eternal, we experience it as a beginning. Now, as we're raised in this world, we're kind of given a certain idea of time. When we come across the Bhagavatam's idea of time, our idea of time stretches. But even then it's hard. I mean, yesterday we were here in the class and we were talking about, you know, Brahma's time, and then we can hardly comprehend a day of Brahma. What to speak of a lifetime of Brahma? What to speak of one breath of Vishnu? So our concept of time is very difficult to comprehend. So time is eternal, but from our experiences, sometimes it has small and sometimes it's big. So this is one of the aspects of his question. Tell about this eternal time, his shortness and his beginnings. And next thing is very interesting. Yavachya karma gatayo. As long as in terms of the work performed as it may be. Yadvisha dvijya sutam. In other words, time and our experience of time is connected to work. They're completely intertwined. So, for example, according to the work previously done, someone becomes a Brahma and their experience of time is in a certain way. And in our own lives, we're experiencing time in a certain way because of our previous works. So our experience of time is connected to karma. That word there, karma, is there. And also what's important here is the word dvija satatama, which is, dvija means twice born Brahmana, and satama means the most important. So he's talking about to Shukadeva Goswami. In other words, he's asking very important, deep questions to someone who actually is a dvija, is a Brahmana. But not just that, he's the best of Brahmanas. So he's the most qualified to be able to answer these questions. And actually, this verse, you could say, prompt us with thinking, well, what about the world? The world needs brahmanas. It needs people who have this deep spiritual intellect, who are living this life of goodness been described here. We want even general brahmanas, just people who have some knowledge about the truth. But what to speak of those who are the uttama, the highest brahmanas, those who really have the knowledge. Anyway, I was thinking about this. I mean, I was reflecting that we had initiation recently. And I was thinking, well, how many brahmanas are we making currently? How many people are we making brahmanas in our region? That may say something controversial, people hope on no minds. In the UK, there are 48 million traditional English people. Let's say in the UK, let's say in this region, there's 10 million traditional English people. So how many traditional English people do we initiate per year? So one thing is first initiation. How many of those first initiates get to the point of brahminical initiation? Probably not very many. Are we initiating one traditional English person a year? Two, anyone? In a region, how many do we do? I'm not talking about people who come from other countries or people who are from traditional other families, but English, traditional English people, how many are we making into brahmanas per year? My wife wants to tell me. We don't look at the body concept. We look at the body concept. We don't at all. And maybe that's why we're not doing it. Maybe that's why we're not making any traditional English brahmanas, because we're not measuring it. I think it's very important. That's what I'm prompting here. That if we want to change the world, what are we measuring to change the world? If we're not trying to measure how many brahmanas to make, therefore we'll never find if we've ever made them, because we're not measuring it. So measuring, a targeting is very important. Obviously there's a Krishna element, but I'm kind of influenced by this comment that Srila Prabhupada made when asked how the movement would go on. He said, by intelligence and good organization. I'm also influenced by a conversation I had when I was in Hungary. And they were targeting making a certain number of brahmacharis. Yes, the body concept of life. And they had a good reason for it, because they had all these ladies and they were thinking, well, how can we marry them? It's a very particular, who are they going to marry? We don't make brahmacharis to become future husbands, then who's going to marry all these wonderful ladies? So they had a strategy to increase the number of devotees to be able to have enough people to be able to have their social development. And they, I think particularly for the farm, they had to make 10 devotees in 1 year. I thought it's an interesting concept. Okay, maybe some controversial elements to it. But the point is they were thinking about an issue, a sociological development, and how can we reach that target. So how many brahmanas do we want in the UK? How many brahmanas, okay, forget about the UK, this is the Manor region. How many brahmanas do we want from our region? How many of them do we expect to come from the traditional English denomination, and how many do we expect to come from the traditional Indian denomination? What's our mix that we're aspiring for? And how will we get there? What is the targeting to do it? At the moment, let's say we're making two a year. That means our total is going to be about 120, because they're going to die eventually. So we make two a year. When they get to 80, they retire. So more or less, you've got active Brahmins. You may have 120 in your preaching strategy. So is that our limit? Is that where we're going? Are we wanting to make 120 brahmanas in our region of 10 million people? I don't know. Just a question. So here, the world needs these brahmanas, and our movement is meant to provide these brahmanas. I want to go to the next verse, because it's actually full of, this whole thing is full of controversy, that this verse and purport, that the world needs to hear. So many things that the people take for granted, this verse and purport is just questioning those things. And again, it's so much full of wealth. He said, the next verse is, he's talking about karma, samavi. First of all, yasmin yata yena, in which, by which, as far as. Upagri, it takes over. Karma completely takes over your life. It accumulates. Your actions are accumulating. And it's also balanced. It's probably use the word proportionate. What you do completely takes over your life, and you will accumulate the results of it in proportion to what you're doing. It also talks about the modes of material nature, the living entity, and desire. These things all combine. Action, time, a higher power that's forcing these events, modes of material nature, the living entity, all these things are combined. Now, who knows this? Who knows that there's a higher power that's directing their, that's controlling their activities? People think they can do whatever they like. No. The Bhagavad Gita says, Adishtanam tatataka karanam char pritak vidah vididash tapritak chesta divam chayavantra panchimam. The place, the person, the endeavor, the instruments, and ultimately the divam, divine nature, the God, Krishna. So this verse also has very similar kind of elements that talk about existence. Control. You become controlled by your own activity. But it's fair. It's completely balanced. It's completely fair. What's happening in this universe is completely fair. It's proportionate to what you're putting into it, is what you get. That's a very important information for people. They're confused, bewildered. Why is it happening to me? Especially when you hear some of the controversy that Prabhupada points out here. And there are the modes of material nature. So the one thing is the work you're doing, but there's also how you're doing it, the consciousness that you're doing it in. Everyone's eating food, but the modes of material nature mean that some food are going to elevate your consciousness, promote you higher up the scale of the universe, and some foods are going to degenerate you into perhaps even a human, into a non-human form. And then it talks about the desires. So all these things are intertwined. You may have a desire to do certain things, but that's in a framework of, well, you can't just desire it. You have to live your life in a certain way in order to fulfill those desires. So in Prabhupada kind of touches some of these points in this translation, Prabhupada adds the point about being promoted to the different species of life, demigods, although in the word for it, it's not there, but Prabhupada's giving us the framework to understand what he's talking about. That these modes of material nature are everywhere in the universe, that this is not just the only place that exists, this globe that we call Earth. There's life everywhere, and some of them are higher and some of them are lower. And we, as citizens of this place, are trained from birth to not be allowed to see what is actually going on in this world. So here, Prabhupada point, I mean, it's finishing, Prabhupada brings it out. He didn't hammer it, but it's quite clear. Life in the higher planets, known as the abodes of the denizens of heaven, is obtained not by the strength of spacecraft, as is now being contemplated by the inexperienced scientist, but by works done in the mode of goodness. He also mentions here that the moon is a heavenly planet. So Prabhupada is saying quite clearly here, you can't go there by a spacecraft. He said it again later on. You can't simply go by electronic mechanism. All right, hang on, what's happening here? I've seen the pictures. I've seen the pictures of the moon, so the Earth from the moon. I've seen the footage of people blasting off from the moon. What's going on? Well, you can't, when you scratch a bit, you find it's all a lie. It's all a lie. Now, okay, I want to say something to kind of balance that a little bit. I heard a presentation on this topic, controversial topic about the moon. It was by Brahma Tirtha Prabhu. And he was talking about a conversation he had with Sataputta. And Sataputta was calculating the trajectory of the rockets going to the moon. And he was saying that according to the trajectory that they're saying, they obviously have not gone to the moon. But he put it down to the fact that they're giving these false coordinates so the Russians can't follow the same path. They're taking the Russians off the path. Anyway, it's one way of looking at it. But if you look at the statements of Prabhupada consistently, he doesn't accept at all, because he had this understanding that the moon is a heavenly planet. If you want to go there, you can only go there by living a life of the mode of goodness. And then if you can find the footage of this so-called evidence of them going to the moon, you quickly think, hang on a minute, that doesn't make any sense. For example, I saw a little footage of this this kind of, you know, the capsule spitting itself off the Earth, so off the moon after it's finished the walking, and the camera pans. It moves. It pans. Who's on the moon panning moving the camera to their pictures? And anyway, there's so many little, I won't get into all the different kind of, but you can search for this stuff if you want to. So that's a lie. Now, there's some devotees, I was talking to a devotee what is truth? What is actually true that we're being told? What is true? And actually, there's a real shortage of real truths. I mean, for example, we know from a very early on in our Christian consciousness, we don't accept evolution. No, that's another lie that's been propagated. I'm just going to touch a few things to agitate your minds. Oil. Where does oil come from? We were all taught that oil comes from fossils, fossilized dinosaur bones. Do you remember this? It was a lie. It's a lie by the companies who wanted to sell oil, fabricated this lie, so you make think that oil is a short commodity. It's all a fabricated lie to get us to think in certain ways. This is why we need brahmanas. Okay, one thing is, we need brahmanas to tell us the truth, but also to tell us how to deal with the false position that we're in. And actually, I was thinking about this a little bit. There are many commentators on this field of, you could say, manipulated information, this propaganda. Actually, based on a point I was making before about brahmanas, there are people with huge, vast resources of money who are manipulating information to keep the cash register being filled, to get people to buy. So we have to apply the same type of methodology to also have propaganda to get people to become devotees of Krishna. When I was part of a reading group, some very wonderful devotees. And anyways, in the room I was meeting with yesterday, they were making a calculation about some properties the manor has, and they didn't rub it out, so I thought, that was interesting. And it's about the value of this building, what it costs to renovate, and what its revenue income will be. So clearly, the manor measures money, and they measure the results of that money in terms of accumulation of more money. So we also have to do the same thing. We have to invest resources in propaganda and then measure the results of that propaganda to get what we want. We don't want people to become more and more consumers. We want people to dedicate their life to Krishna. But that's going to take some, investment of time and energy. So I was just wondering, have we calculated what the human and physical resources are required to capitalize on our Krishna consciousness potential in our region? Now, one time related, I was doing a study. I wanted to know, well, what happens if the whole country became cow protectors? How could that be done practically? And one of the questions you come to, well, actually, it's not realistic for the whole all the 10 million cows in this country to be cow protected cows, because there are a lot of people who don't care whether they're cows and the milk is from a protected cow. So what is the percentage? What are the percentage of people who are likely to want milk from protected cows? I don't know what the figure is. Maybe 10%, I don't know. You have to come to some kind of figure, then you realize, okay, this is a reasonable target. So of all the people, let's say 10 million people in our region, how many of them could we expect to take up the process of Krishna consciousness to some degree? What is that number? What's a reasonable target? Some people have fixed their own religions, they're not our candidates. So what is the number? And of those, how many can we turn into become these brahmanas? So if we haven't got a plan to do it, then we haven't got a plan. And I remember many years ago, Anuttama was doing this leadership and management course, and I went to that course, and he said, you only succeed in what you're measuring. So we're seeing there's huge amounts of propaganda materialistically to keep people completely bound up in the material concept of life and all the falsities that is. So there's a need for real wisdom. So Prabhupada points out this thing about planetary travel. We're being completely bamboozled. What do we know? Has anybody been in a space rocket? How high is that? What's the highest anyone's ever traveled? 45,000 feet, something like that, in a plane. We look out, we just see the Earth flat. I'm not getting to the globe and I'm not getting to that area. But we see the world in a certain way. Now, there are some planes that travel 78,000 feet. They still see the Earth as flat. So who has actually gone? Which living being do we know, do we trust, who's left the orbit of this planet? We don't know anyone. We just know that some people say they've done it, and we accept what they say. And we see some pictures. Just for example, just as a point on how you set your minds, there's no real pictures of the Earth from space. They're all computer graphics. Now, why would that be? If there's someone out there looking at the Earth, why don't we find an actual real picture of the Earth from outer space? I'll ask a few more interesting things. The Hubble Space Telescope, apparently it's 25,000 miles out there looking at the Earth. Apparently, amazing figure is out there floating around in its orbit, whatever. Apparently, the same pictures you find from this Hubble Space Telescope are found with a high-altitude plane with the same camera, taking pictures of outer space. So the same pictures that are from the Hubble Space Telescope out there somewhere in the space are the same pictures you can find from a high-altitude plane flying around the sky. Point I'm making is, we don't know what's going on. How do we know? Where are we formulating our worldview? So when you look at it, you find actually that why are these space people in green screens, blue screens? Why are they being filmed in front of blue screens? Now, if you know what blue screens are, it's what they do in film. You can be fighting with a pterodactyl by having a blue screen, and by computer graphics, they can simulate this thing, you fighting with a pterodactyl. So using that same methodology in imagery of space. So what I'm saying is, because Prabhupada is pointing out here, you can't go there. You cannot go to the moon by a mechanical process. You cannot go there by an electronic mechanism. So either Srila Prabhupada is a bit naive, or someone else is giving us, untruths. I'm favoring Srila Prabhupada's view here, that what we've been told there, it's false. And Srila Prabhupada's view is true. The Bhagavad Gita tells us, a bit of the argument Prabhupada raises, he says that how is it possible that the earth is that the moon is responsible for vegetation. It says the moon is responsible for the rasa of the vegetation on Earth. How can there be no vegetation on the moon? Therefore, Prabhupada said they didn't go there. He says he's so convinced about what Shastra says that he refutes what other people say. So it's very important then that people really have the benefit of this Shastra. And where are they going to get it from? I was thinking, do we have a strategy to place Krishna conscious truths into the educational system? Is there any devotees working on such a strategy? Because that's where people are taught things. That's where you teach. There's a picture there where you can get a one-toed horse coming from a five-toed horse. Why? Well, because there's a picture of a five-toed horse, a three-toed horse, and then evolution. Just by some pictures in a book. And then they have a picture in the book talking about primordial soups, and then something came out of that primordial soup just by a few pictures on it, and the kids are being taught this. And it just stays with them for the whole life. So where is our strategy to change that? You're up against it, because obviously the strategy that's keeping that going, there's huge powers around it. But again, what are we doing? What are we doing about it? What's our movement doing about it? We could ask that question. So here, what's important is, so what do we do about it? Okay, I think for me, the fact that Lord Chaitanya appeared in a occupied country, I think is very significant for me. That is showing actually, it's not about changing politics. It's not about changing manipulative leadership. It's about being Krishna conscious. And this verse talks about, well, what do you want? You can have whatever you want to do. If you want to go to the heavenly planets, you can do it. You worship certain demigods, you'll go there. If you want to go to Pitriloka, you can go there. Now, I don't know what's happening in Pitriloka. I know that Yamaraj is there. But what else is happening? Well, presumably there must be some enjoyments there in Pitriloka. If you want to enjoy yourself in the material world in some way, you want to help the earth, you can do it. You can do whatever you want to do. If you want a mode of goodness with a tinge of devotional service, you can do it with piety. You can do it with some jnana. You can do it with some karma. But if you want pure devotional service, then you can also have that. This is what this verse is saying here. You can do whatever you want to do, but there's a certain way of doing it. But if you want pure devotional service, then you have to do it with this, the unmixed devotional service and being transcendental. So, as Prabhupada says, such a transcendental kingdom is not a myth, but is as factual as the moon. So there's a lot of myths going on in this world, but the transcendental kingdom is factual. And these books are telling us how we can actually make the choice. First of all, understand that there are choices, and the choices are in our hands, and train us that we make the right choices to want to go back home, back to Godhead. So here are the points that I got from this verse. Any comments, questions?
Hello, testing 1, 2, 3. Lift off. Oh, sorry. Yes, I have to follow these parties here. So, you said talked about Lord Chaitanya being in an occupied country and just being Krishna conscious. And Bhaktisiddhanta, when he met Prabhupada says, you know, this Gandhi, the British occupying, how can we spread Krishna consciousness? Bhaktisiddhanta told Prabhupada, don't worry about these things. Lord Chaitanya didn't try to get rid of the Muslims or even convert the fishermen to becoming vegetarian in Puri. He just became Krishna conscious. So my question to you is, you mentioned that at the end of the class. So, but before that, you were mentioning about changing information. So, you know, it's kind of like, how much should we worry about all these things, and how much should we just try to become Krishna conscious? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think oftentimes we worry about it, and we can't do anything about it, and that's the thing. What can we possibly? What's our solution to it? We don't even understand the complexity of what these powerful people are doing. So how can we unpick it? We can't unpick it. But what's in our hands is to try and spread Krishna consciousness. That's what we can do. But I think that's what our contribution to the world is, make a real difference. Because even while people are being exploited by the materialists, at least they can be blissful in Krishna consciousness while they're being exploited. I mean, look at some of the... there's 10,000 devotees in Russia. Where did they start off? They started off in a very oppressed place. Now look at it. I mean, how many devotees in China? We don't know, because it's all underground, but there's thousands of devotees there. So, presumably. So, I mean, we're fortunate that we're in the West, where it's meant to be free. But when you look at it, actually, we're not quite free at all. But what we can do, we have the opportunity to spread Krishna consciousness, and the government is allowing us to spread Krishna consciousness. So we're in a great fortunate position. I remember when I joined this movement, we used to get arrested on Harinam. We all got, you know, this van pulled up. We all got shoved into the back of this van. I went to the police station. That's unheard of now. When was the last time a devotee got arrested for vote distribution? I spent 2 nights in jail in Chelmsford. I spent a very, you know, bleak afternoon in some seaside resort in Scotland or something. Actually, we spent a very ecstatic afternoon in Glasgow with a Harinam party. Were you there? Well, the Hiring Arm Party in Glasgow, they arrested the whole Hiring Arm Party and they kept us there with the Madonga and cartels. And we had Mark Vishnuswamy with us. So that was it. Madonga and cartels. And then we were chanting. But now you don't get arrested for Hiring Arm. So what a fantastic place we're in. Okay, so the government are pillaging everyone, but we can spread Christian consciousness.
Brahminical qualities, and one of the qualities of a Brahmin is that they're independent. They don't depend on anyone for their maintenance or anything like that. So then they have more time to do what they need to do, the important thing. They're not restricted or enforced by any institution or authority or corporation. So I was thinking what you were saying about how we're going to make Brahmins and spread Christian consciousness. So the independent Brahmins should take it upon themselves to go out and preach and not depend on any huge institution or anything. So we need to really just take it upon ourselves to develop the qualities of a Brahmin, and then without depending on anyone else, just go out and preach Christian consciousness.
I think in practice you see that when people are independent, well, how are they independent? What is their how are they maintaining themselves? If you're a sannyasi, you have a source of income. You go to someone's house and they give you money. You have a source of revenue. So let's suppose you're a Brahminical householder. How do you make your living? Are you going to go to work? Then you spend less time preaching. Or are you going to be a book distributor? And therefore, you're driven by money to sell books. So it's possible that people can do it independently. But suppose the society said, okay, we're going to give you, we're going to look after, here's a house, here's all your financial needs, just preach. And we're not going to measure you for money. We're going to measure you for other things. Maybe we're going to measure you for how many doors you knock on. Maybe we're going to how many people you're talking to. You maybe measure some more simplistic things. So far, we've had to measure a lot of money. We measure our preaching by how much money is brought in. But maybe it's time now where we have a financial stability, especially here, that we measure something else. We give people a not a financial measurement, but some kind of outreach measurement, that the time they're spending interfacing with people. Why is it that we have people, for example, I was thinking about this, why is it we have people now who've been devotees for many years selling books? Because there's money. There's money in book distribution. There's no money in cultivating Well, people who are doing it are getting some money from it. Sorry?
Like who?
Well, there's still money oiling the system.
You don't make any money selling books. You cover your expenses, you have little money left over, tiny, tiny, tiny wee bit. You're only saying that because you haven't done it.
I've done it.
It's a myth. When people think that you go out on Sankirtan as a grasper, paying 20% above the BBT price, and you're raking it in, there are easier ways of making money than going out and booking.
Sure.
I can tell you.
But there's still money in it.
There's no money in it. There is no money in
it. At least your current expenses. The point I wanted to touch was. No, it's not a myth. I've done books. No, I accept your point. I can't maintain myself on Sankirtan.
There's no one in this country that's doing that because it's impossible.
Okay, the point I want to raise is there's even less money in outreach. If you try to cultivate a traditional English person to become a devotee, you may never see any financial return in it. Never. Because that's what they don't give like that. So that's a lot more, there's less, you could say, financial lucre. You can't measure it in that terms. You have to measure something else. Therefore, I'm saying it's harder, and that's probably why we're not doing it.
But it's not happening.
No,
I was making a point that Brahmins are meant to be independent. I wouldn't say that they should all go out and put distribution because it's impossible. They can't. But you said, the society should encourage priests to provide facility and house, but it's not happening. Is it? It hasn't.
I'm not giving any solutions for it. What I'm perhaps nudging is there should be an analysis there. What are we targeting? How do we get there? That's what I was raising. I'm not trying to solve the solutions, but first we have to start asking the questions. What is the issue? I mean, for example, I did a study one time. I wanted to know how many cows would we need for the manor to have all its milk from a protected cow? So every department in the manor, all the milk comes from a cow that's protected. So that was my first question. What was the figure? Interestingly enough, it came to 150. 150 cows, calves, bulls, and oxen. So I guess it's the same thing. Well, how many devotees do we want to make in our area? And the next question, well, how can we do it? Sorry. Microphone.
Hare Krishna. You said something about that if we cannot measure, then it cannot be successful.
We had a leadership and management course, and the devotee, I think it was Anutama, he said you won't be successful in something that you don't measure. For example, in our spiritual life, we measure 16 rounds. We measure 480 principles. We measure happens 4 in the morning for Mangal Arati. We have certain measurements that we're taking for our life. So if we're not measuring it, we won't be successful in it.
Does that mean that what I'm taking from this is that this measurement is only a tool for you to progress in your effort, but then this measurement is not the basis of your effort? You cannot sort of only make effort based on the statistics because, you know, well, this is just... because we were trying to distribute, and then, you know, Prabhupada never had any clue how many people he's going to turn into a sannyasi or a brahmana. But then he ended up being successful. I mean, there's the transcendental sort of bow.
Well, he said there's 108 temples before there were 108 temples, so he had an idea in his mind where he was going. Now, was it fully quantified? I don't know. But I think for ourselves, we should at least have an exercise that we're trying to do something, and then we accept where we go.
Okay. Now I have a question. So it's more like technical. So we are saying that all planets have beings on them, and that, you know, Gunai, that were kind of composed of these material elements of, you know, five elements, plus mind, intelligence, and ego. And we cannot see them, you know, see the other beings on other planets with our, you know, material perception. So does that mean that their composition is different? And does that mean that, you know, the elements are actually, what it means is that it's subtle. It's not like a description of particles or something material, but rather it has a more subtle basis than what we can perceive?
Well, that's how it seems to be. There's a devotee called Sadaputta, who one of our scientists, he passed away. He gets into this in a lot more detail. He wrote this book called Alien Identities, and he talks about different experiences that people have from other humanoid type beings, and some of them have the ability to walk through material elements. Some of them are kind of more gross and they use like mechanical machinery. Some of them are more angelic and they don't use machines. And these are a lot of testimonies for people's interactions like that. Interestingly enough, if ever you give out the Veda book and you sell it to people and you tell them about how people have out-of-body experiences or pre-life memories, and you probably find that people will tell you their stories. And a lot of people have out-of-body experiences where they're experiencing their self being detached from their physical body, oftentimes through medical procedures. So there's a lot of testimony where people are experiencing a subtler sense of identity than the gross physical. Now, when we dream at night, we have a little experience of that. And sometimes we lament, "I was having a really good dream. I didn't want to come out of it." But we're experiencing a subtle existence. So there is testimony. In fact, there are even pilot. Again, information is being suppressed. But if you find testimonies of people who are following a craft from a different place, and suddenly it disappears. So it seems to be able to shift through different spheres of existence. I don't agree with what is twitching to say something here.
Just a simple thing. Okay. They live on the sun planet, so they have bodies that are made of fire and building. You know, it's like constitution.
And that's mentioned here, the sun god. There is a devotee actually who apparently was on the sun planet, and they went there through hypnotic regression. And I asked her, I said, "What's about the variety?" She said, "Well, there's a lot of variety in fire also." Anyway, so we can't understand how you can live on the fire. We do know that, on this earth, there are things that live at the mouth of volcanoes in the sea, these volcanoes spewing out, and there are things that can live there in that kind of heat conditions. So we do experience some things. We can't imagine how they're doing it, but they're able to do certain things. For example, sometimes they've cracked open a rock and they find a frog coming out, and it lived. This frog was somehow entombed in this rock for a long time. So there are many things about how things live that we're not aware of. So yes, now why is it when we look at the moon, how strong a telescope have we got? What do we see there? And what kind of existence do the people on the moon have? Anyway, so apart from the fact that I'm suggesting they didn't go there mechanically, even if we were to go, even if we could go to the moon, would we see them anyway? I don't know. Maybe there are a different subtle being that we couldn't see them. See, there's a class full of controversies today. Okay.
Does that mean the thinner your material covering is?
Sorry?
Does that mean the more, well, then we have different levels of material covering. Does that affect your consciousness?
Well, you get a body around your consciousness, for sure. So you're given a body, a base around your consciousness. So, for example, Lord Brahma, we understand his body is composed primarily of intelligence. How do we conceive? We can't even see intelligence. How do we conceive of that? Sometimes it describes that there are beings that you're not quite sure that they're not there. Describe the Bhagavatam. It's like the corner of your eyes. There's something you can't. It's gone. So there are beings like that. There are beings you're not quite sure whether they're human or non-human. Kimpurushas? Are they human? The question like that. There are beings described as being winged, like the angels. That they're described there. They have wings, and so there are some creatures described. There's 400,000 human species. We get what 15, 20 described in the Bhagavatam. So there's a lot that's not been described. So the world is, again. The point is that we're not being told even what people are experiencing. That's all being suppressed. But the Bhagavatam gives us revelations.
There's one verse in the Bhagavatam says there's certain beings, they're able to be present but invisible. And the demigods have this city and some other celestial beings. And Nitya Siddhas from the spiritual world, they can also be present and invisible.
And in the pasadena of Krishna, we're problemed with the stories of beings being able to change their shape. Sages becoming a deer because apparently a deer enjoys more. How can we conceive of these things?
I have a question. So I have a really good friend who doesn't lie, and he claims that somehow or another he left his body and was flying through space, and what must have been about 8 hours on planet Earth seemed to be about 1 or 2 years. In this other space, and he's wondering if those planets were Vaikuntha. He's not sure. because he's recently been studying the Vedas as well. And
well, that's straight out of our Shastra, that idea of different existent times. There was someone who went to visit Lord Brahma, and he was there for a very short period of time. In fact, we know that in the path of Krishna, Brahma went away for a moment, and a year had gone by. So someone went to Lord Brahma, and he was there. He came back, and generations had passed. Nobody even remembered him. He'd gone. So yes, that time is different in different parts of the universe. Was it the moon? 30 days is here for one of their days. So yeah, time's here, but there it's like it's much longer. So that experience would be corroborated. So we'd say, yeah, that's interesting, corroborating information. Is it true or not? We don't know, but it's interesting that what he's saying is what we would expect to see from a Vedic, universal traveler. We'd expect to see those things.
So would that be the heavenly planets then?
It certainly would be heavenly. The same thing happened there's also subterranean heavenly planets that are kind of where God isn't remembered, where there's a lot of enjoyment. What their time frame, I don't know. But certainly heavenly would be attributed like that. Longer lifespan, longer lifetimes, for sure.
Thank you.
Okay, we should end there. Chu Bhavatamaki.